This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with the legendary political consultant, Gus Weil. Much to talk about with Gus Weil, as we are now just over 12 weeks away from Election Day. He's participated in a few of those in Louisiana. Mary Landrieu is running for a fourth term. We'll discuss this and more, but she has agreed to four debates. So has Rob Manus, the Republican challenger from the Tea Party. Bill Cassidy, thus far, has not agreed to any debates. Will the congressman from Baton Rouge show up? We'll talk about that with Gus. Also, Paul Feinbaum, the noted SEC analyst and author, a man from Alabama, will comment about the SEC in 2014 with LSU trying to become conference champions again for the first time in 3 years. Now the news on WRKN. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. That's your local number outside the area. Please give us a call at 877-217-5757, wherever you may be. You may reach us online, inkstershow@wrkf.org, and you may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. We start with Gus Weil, the fabled political consultant who's been around the Louisiana political scene for well over half a century, now joining us from lovely Livonia. Good morning, Gus Weil.
Good morning to you, Jim.
You know, Gus, it was 33 years ago today that I graduated from Louisiana State University, and the commencement speaker was none other than Gus Weil.
And I remembered it well because you were the only one in that great crowd who dozed off during my speech, so it made a lasting impression.
Actually, I think Donna Brazile was dozing off right next to me.
Yeah, I think she was too.
but you gave a stirring address. I remember.
I don't remember, you know.
And that was the first graduation class for Chancellor Jim Wharton. You remember him, don't you?
Yeah, sure, of course I do. I like the heck out of him. He's a fine man and a good chancellor.
A brilliant chemist. It's kind of an interesting thing that a chemist would become an administrator, but Chancellor Wharton, he was head of LSU during some tough times as far as budget concerns, and the same has been true for the chancellors over the last few years. It's not not an easy time, and we'll probably talk about that before we part company with you today. But we do have an election in just over 12 weeks. 12 weeks from Tuesday is November 4. Qualifying is in a couple of weeks, 2 weeks from today. And Mary Landrieu is seeking a fourth term against the challenge of two well-oiled, well-heeled Republicans, Bill Cassidy and Rob Manus. And Manus is showing up for every event. He spoke to the press club. Bill Cassidy has refrained from the press club at Baton Rouge. He's not agreed to any debates. Earlier this week, Mary Landrieu agreed to four debates, including one that will be co-sponsored by WRKF and WAFB. What do you think about Cassidy and his approach right now?
Well, it could be any one of a number of reasons why. A, he has a poll that shows him doing better when he keeps quiet. That's possible. Always when you deal with politics, look for a poll, because nowadays it's such an important instrument. Although back in the day, when John McKiffin ran for governor, polls were not that important.
But it's to not show up for a debate, and right now, of course, the congressman has plenty of time to do so, but he hasn't shown up for a debate or the press club. It smacks of some complacency.
Well, the least communicative politician in Louisiana is our governor, who comments to the national press and on national topics, and doesn't talk too much to the Louisiana press. Anyway, getting back to the doctor, he may not have the confidence. That's another possibility, that he just doesn't feel that he's up enough on the myriad of issues that might arrive in a senatorial campaign. That's another reason.
He's been in Congress for 6 years, Gus. He's a bright man. He's a big boy. I think he can do very well in a debate. My guess is that he has handlers, guys like you, telling him, why take the risk?
Yeah, as I said, a poll, yeah. Don't mess with things. They're going too well. But I think she's going to give him a heck of a fight.
Well, Mary Landrieu has debated all comers since the first election. She debated Woody Jenkins. She debated Susie Terrell. She debated John Kennedy. Now she's going to debate Cassidy. I thought that her
commercials with her father were delightful.
Did you?
Yeah. Really thought they were different, and they weren't heavy. They had just the light touch of a daughter and a father. I thought whoever came up with that did a fine job.
All right. Well, Governor Jindal this week went to the Texas-Mexico border to take a look at the nation's immigration crisis. He went with the embattled Superintendent of State Police, Mike Edmondson. The colonel took a boat ride down the Rio Grande, taking a look at these kids who are coming. 57,000 of them have come to Texas, mostly from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, and they are concerned about this. But Kip Holden, our mayor, who is running for lieutenant governor, he was quoted on this show the other day. He made the statement that for the first time in Louisiana history, a governor has said that the Texas-Mexico border is a threat to Louisiana's security.
Well, you know, Kip may be doing the governor wrong. The governor may have plans for annexing the border for Louisiana. In other words, it becomes a part of our topographical terrain.
That would be a circuitous route from Morgan City or Grand Isle to Mexico City.
You alone could have done it.
Well, what
declare, declare war on Texas and Mexico.
Well, he did bring the head of state police with him, but the governor, as noted on this show, spends time in places like that, but yet one of the highest crime zones in America as far as area codes is 70805. He lives right on the fringe of it, and I don't see him walking through 70805, but he's walking down the border between Texas and Mexico.
No, someone else is problems, and at a great distance are always highly desirable, comparable, comparing them to our problems. My goodness, why would a man have to go that distance? There are places in Baton Rouge that, very frankly, I would be afraid to drive through at night. You should not be that way. It's gotten that way, though. You know, that's interesting. The thought was that when Kip Holden was elected, I know people felt that would really help racial harmony between blacks and whites in Baton Rouge. But I don't think it's helped that much, if at all. I still think that town is torn between those two races, and it's a shame.
Well, we're probably one of the last vestiges of the old South, a sad vestige where we have all-white country clubs still in existence in Louisiana. And in this community.
You know, I'll tell you the interesting story about country clubs. In 1963, when John McKithen ran for governor, the Baton Rouge Country Club did not let in, you're right, certain minority groups, not just blacks, but certain other minority groups. It was so interesting. At that late date, we're talking now about 1964, and I remember doctor's offices in Baton Rouge, some of them were segregated. The surgeon I went to had a wall down the center of his office for blacks and whites. And then across the river at Port Allen, the courthouse had drinking fountains, said white, and I think they used the word colored. But I don't know if we've come very far since. I really don't.
Well, we have this tolerance ordinance that's coming up for a vote a week from today, actually a week from yesterday, the Metro Council. It is at this point not expected to get support, at least the requisite support for it to become the law of the city.
And what would it say just in a moment?
Well, it would say that we as employers and as housing owners cannot discriminate against people who are of their race or their religion. We can't discriminate. It even has veterans listed, but it also has sexual orientation, which is which is the one that the opponents are focusing upon.
Well, you know, that's shocking and sad that in this day and age, a major city, and Baton Rouge, I think, could be called a major city, the home of not one but two universities, Louisiana State and Southern, that we would still be clinging to those outdated and bygone harmful outlooks on other people. Is that there's something almost shocking. It is shocking. I mean, we're talking about 2014. We're not talking about the 60s or the 50s when Judge Perez was running things. I wonder what happened to Baton Rouge.
Well, this will be a test of the city. The business community is on record as being supportive of this, and the Metro Council, which is taking heed from several ministers in the area, they're saying, nope, let's not do it. At least a majority of the council members are to this point. So the religious leaders are very powerful in this community and others, but I think especially so in our community, Gus.
And they're against it?
Pardon me?
Religious leaders are against this?
Yes.
Well, then, well, what about the very basis of Christ's philosophy about treat your neighbors as you would treat yourself, or do unto others what you would have them do unto you, cast not the first sin? Cast out the stone. What about all the very tenets basic to all religions? How can a preacher, a man of God, adopt those woeful policies?
We haven't heard whether your former client Jimmy Swaggart is on board or not. It would be interesting to get his take on this.
You know, I would bet that he's for the that vote, because he would be for it, because his church certainly welcomes all. I watch the services sometimes on television because he's so good at what he does, and he's got blacks and whites, and I think they would let gays in without any hesitation. I can't speak for him, but I believe that.
Mm-hmm. Well, when he was embroiled in this controversy in 1988, he had a Jewish man as his public relations specialist.
Oh, me? My memory is not what it was.
Well,
Jim.
He never, I don't think he ever tried to convert you, but he did try to get you to give up cigars, didn't he?
Yes, and what I did was I made it a rule never to smoke around him. I'll tell you another man of God whom I represented. A lot of people don't know this. I represented Reverend T.J. Jemison, who was the president of the National Baptist Conference, the largest black denominational group in the world. And I traveled all over the country with Reverend Jemison and members of his board, and I think I gave myself a bad back from carrying Jemison's luggage in and out of airports. And he was a delightful man. And I might say quite sincere, I never saw him take a drink. I never saw him light a cigarette.
Well, I used to see him drink lemonade at the Piccadilly on Westmoreland. He used to hang out there quite a bit.
I believe lemonade was okay.
I think lemonade's all right. Well, we'll talk when we return after a short break about a man who says he's never had a drink, never smoked a cigarette, Edwin Washington Edwards. He's 87 years old today, and he credits his longevity to the fact that he has lived a life of moderation, at least moderate on some.
Yes.
297-5633 is your number, 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org. And you may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show, back after this 1.5-minute pause on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, please call 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org online. Our guest for a while longer is Gus Weil, the legendary political consultant from Louisiana. And we were discussing his former client, Edwin Edwards, turning 87 today, 6 days after his son turned one. But Edwin Edwards is 87 on 8-7, and for a man who served 10% of his life in federal prison, Gus Weil, he has shown remarkable resiliency.
I stand in awe of him, I guess, because I'm almost 82. I just can't get over him with that young baby and that gorgeous wife. I stand in awe. I think what Edward says, his approach to life is fascinating. I think he looks upon life as a great big menu, and you pick from the menu what you want, and you turn down what you don't want. But one good thing about him, he doesn't preach to other people.
That's true. He does not do that. There's a story, perhaps a bit apocryphal, but I heard that he was rushed to the hospital the other day to see the birth of his fourth wife.
You know who would get the biggest laugh out of that? Edwin W. Edwards.
That's right.
Edwards comes from most people don't even know that, from a strict Pentecostal background in Crowley, out of Crowley, in the country, really. And he came from tenant farmers, very poor people. And the rules were not to drink and not to smoke. And neither he nor any member of his, neither he nor any of his siblings did. So they stuck to that pretty good. Now, if he slipped in other ways, heck, nobody's perfect.
Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on with Gus Weil.
Yes. Do you agree with Richard Cohen's column in yesterday's Advocate that Richard Nixon's Southern strategy led to the GOP welcoming creationists, racists, gun nuts, anti-abortion zealots, immigrant haters, and all of all sorts, and homophobes?
All right, Dan, sounds like you've got quite a party going there. And we'll talk more about the legacy of Richard Milhouse Nixon tomorrow on this show with Paul Pascoff, the retired LSU history professor. 36 years he was a professor of history at LSU. We're going to have to call Gus back, Frank. And Richard Nixon resigned 40 years ago, August 9th, which will be Saturday. He was about to be impeached. He didn't resign because he wanted to. He resigned because he had to. And he left a legacy of hardball politics that has perhaps even gotten worse since Richard Nixon departed the scene. So Gus is away for a moment, but I think he would agree that Richard Nixon had a mostly negative impact on American politics. What do you think, Gus, about the legacy of Nixon, who resigned 40 years ago this week?
A tragic man, because he was a brilliant man. I mean, really a bright, bright guy who could have done so much good and instead wasted his talents and his efforts on staying in office and getting reelected. And he obviously was, like most of those folks, by that I mean those very talented people, he had serious flaws, and his judgment was lacking. He shared another flaw with Edwin Edwards. I think they were both terrible judges of other men and surrounded themselves in many cases with bad people, and it destroyed them.
Richard Nixon died in 1994, 20 years ago, and it's hard to believe that more time has now elapsed since his death than between the end of his tenure as president and his departure from the world in 1994. But he was a guy who dominated the 20th century. He was vice president for 8 years, and he was elected president twice. As he once noted, only two people in U.S. history have won four national elections, and that's FDR and him. Two of Nixon's were for vice president. But all of that was squandered by the break-in at Watergate, June 17th, 1972, in an election that was not even going to be close.
No, but they had brought on board these terrible characters. You probably remember their names, those guys who burgled Watergate. Incidentally, the Watergate is a magnificent, great, big building. Tell you who had an apartment there, and I visited him there, was the late Senator Russell Long. He lived in the Watergate for many years, as did his cousin Gillis Long,
right,
congressman. It's a huge, big edifice, apartment complex. At any rate, Nixon ended up a very tragic man, and his wife always looked to me like a very sad woman herself.
Well, Bob Dole also lived in the Watergate, as did Monica Lewinsky.
Is that right?
Yes, next door to Bob Dole.
I did not know that. I bet Dole didn't know it.
Well, in fact, the irony was that when Clinton was running for his second term, remember, his opponent was Bob Dole.
Of course.
And Clinton, according to the Star Report, was on the phone with Monica having very personal conversations with Bob Dole in the apartment next door.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. What a small world, huh?
Roger, near LSU, you're on the air with Gus Weil. Hi, Roger.
How you doing, sir?
Fine.
How you doing? Mr. Weil, I want to give a question to you about Jimmy Swaggart.
Yes, sir.
I happen to watch him, too, sometime. And one time I was watching, he put the gay people down in a very angry way. And that was on his program. Another thing he said against Catholics, and I'm a Catholic, we worship Mary. Well, we don't worship Mary. Mr. Swaggart sometimes plays around with the truth.
I can't get involved in that because, you know, what other people believe is kind of their business, you know, and I don't interject myself into it, and hopefully they don't interject themselves into me and my beliefs. Mm-hmm. That's so very private. If you think somebody's a deity or is not a deity, it's all right. Do what you want. Keep quiet about it if you can, but don't try to change other people too much.
You know, Jimmy Swaggart, he does not have a high school degree. Of course, he was born in 1935, and at that time, a lot of people didn't have high school degrees. But,
no.
But he, next to Tom Benson, may be the richest man in Louisiana. It's a story that's largely untold. He has an enormous empire, and he did so without a formal education. And that brings us to the congressional elections. The favorites, according to some, in the 5th and 6th District, Vance McAllister running for re-election, and Garrett Graves in the 6th District, neither man has a college degree, Gus. Is that relevant in today's politics?
Obviously not, but McAllister has other qualifications which have come to the fore and which should hold him in good stead in Louisiana. Is he the kissing congressman?
Yes, he is.
Now, gosh knows how many votes that'll add to him.
Well, it was the late, great John McGinnis who said it takes more than one sex scandal to knock off a Louisiana politician.
Isn't that wonderful? I see that somebody is putting out a scholarship in McGinnis's name, and I sure think that's a fine thing.
At the Manship School, and we'll talk more about that with Jeremy Alford, his successor, next Tuesday.
Well, that's wonderful.
On this show.
I think that was a good, down-to-earth, realistic proposal. I'm for it.
Here's a story that a listener asked about that's been permeating in the last week or so. It's been in several reports. Since 2011, J.P. Morgan Chase has made an estimated $185 million helping American companies renounce their U.S. citizenship to avoid paying taxes in this country, all the while staying put. It's an inversion loophole. A company merges with a smaller one in a lower tax country and then claims to be based there. President Obama's trying to crack down on this, but Congress is not cooperating. He says it costs the U.S. Treasury close to $20 billion, or it will, over the next decade. This seems un-American, Gus Weil.
I bet it doesn't cost those congressmen anything. the money that must be exchanging hands in campaign donations between those giant corporations and our good members of Congress, who I think enjoy a 7% approval rating in America. Can you imagine? 7% of Americans think they're doing a good job. So that doesn't surprise me that Obama can't accomplish that. There's no way they're voting. Well, look, some of the biggest companies in the world do terrible things. There's a bank in New York. How much have they just been fined? $95 billion for stealing. It's on the news today. But here's the interesting thing. You never hear about any of those bankers going to jail. Never. Now, let's say old Gus Weil or Jim Engster hold back a pittance from our income tax. We were hell. We'd be in the federal penitentiary before sunset.
This week, James Brady, the White House press secretary, wounded in an assassination attempt on President Ronald Reagan. He died. He fought a brave fight. He was 73 years old, but on March 30th, 1981, he was actually counted out. He was declared dead by Frank Reynolds, but Jim Brady hung in there, and he became quite a symbol to America.
He was, and his life was as a result of his life, there were some fine deeds done. However, I'm not sure I would have wanted to survive in as he did. He seemed to me to be a really sad, pitiful man based on the terrible wrong done him by that, what was that assassin's name?
John Hinckley.
John Hinckley. And didn't he get out of the...
Yeah, he's out.
He's out.
Mm-hmm.
I bet if I was him, I'd run for office.
I think he might have some difficulty doing that, Gus. And even as cynical as you and I are, I don't think John Hinckley would win.
No, but you don't just debate me that McAllister might win, huh?
Oh, I think he quite likely will win. But that's, come on now, an extramarital affair is not shooting the president. But it is amazing that a man who shot the president of the United States almost killed Ronald Reagan and certainly almost killed Jim Brady, shot a few other people, that he's able to get out of a mental institution that says something about our country.
Declared legally fine. Everything's great.
Yeah, and in fact, a listener, speaking of President Reagan, noted that when Reagan was campaigning against Jimmy Carter, I remember this, he went to the most dangerous crime-infested area of New York City on the campaign trail. And I'll give Reagan credit. He went there and he talked to people. I think they threw rocks at him, but he did go there. So if Ronald Reagan can do that, the listener asks, why can't Bobby Jindal go to 70805?
I'm going to paraphrase somebody else. Bobby Jindal ain't Ronald Reagan.
Quelly in North Baton Rouge. Quelly, you're on the air with Gus Weil.
Hello, good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Fine.
Great. I have a question for Mr. Weil. Mr. Weil, in your honest opinion, or your professional opinion, do you think Mr. Edwards has a chance of winning the seat in the next upcoming election? And by what percentage, win or lose? And my other question to you is, how much better do you think the United States would be if Congress would take their foot off the brake pedal and do their best to help all Americans rather than stifle many of the programs and initiatives that the administration is trying to promote?
Well, on the first part of the question, obviously I can't give you a percentage, but I would not be surprised if Edwards didn't win, because any man at his age who could marry that lady he married and have a young baby and have the energy to run for office and still look good, how dare anybody count him out? So I'm not saying he's going to win, but I'm saying he'll give him a heck of a race.
No doubt he'll be a formidable candidate and quite likely will be in a runoff, but I think the advantage goes to the Republican who makes the runoff at that point, whether it's Garrett Graves or Dan Clater
or Paul Dietzel or Lenar Whitney.
Well, I love them all.
Yeah, but they're a bunch of Republicans. It may only take 15% to make a runoff with the Cajun Prince. The question is whether all these other Republicans will endorse the Republican who's left standing. My guess is that they will.
I would think they usually follow party line pretty good. Mm-hmm. What's interesting on the national level, speaking of Republicans, is that Senator Vitter, who will be a candidate for governor, I read that he's trying to divorce his views, his publicly stated views, from those of Governor Jindal. For example, Jindal is strongly against Common Core. Vitter, who was against Common Core, is now not sure that he's against Common Core.
Oh, he's for Common Core now. Yeah. He was against it, and now he's right. For it, and Jindal was for it, and now he's against it. Those two do not see eye to eye on many things. They have some things in common, both Ivy Leaguers, both Rhodes Scholars, both wanting to be governor, and Jindal having accomplished that. And, of course, David Vitter, I think, at some point will probably also run for president. Right now is the favorite, and that governor's election, mind you, is only 14 months away, Gus. I remember candidates in the old days used to spend 2 or 3 years ramping up to run for governor.
I think Vitter will be very high up there, but I think that the man who's going to make an extraordinary race for governor is our Lieutenant Governor Darden. I think don't underestimate him. He's been doing the right thing for many, many years, and is bright, and more importantly, scandal-free, which Vitter is not.
And the Lieutenant Governor is high on the Duck Dynasty crowd. He likes those people.
I don't share that with him.
Neither does the mayor, Mr. Holden, who says if he's elected lieutenant governor, that he will not be in the same camp with the Duck Dynasty crew. Now, no African American has ever received more than 41% of the votes in a statewide race in Louisiana, and that was President Obama. Can Kip Holden win the lieutenant governor's office, Gus Weil?
It depends who runs against him. If he has real strong opposition, I think they'll beat him. If he has weak or fractured opposition, he has a real good chance. Kip has one strong quality, and I told it to him the first time that he and I got together, and I haven't spoken to him in many years. Kip appeals to white people. There's something in him that white people feel comfortable and safe with him, and not all black politicians possess that quality, but he has it.
He does indeed, and he perhaps can defy the odds. Thank you, Gus Weil. Always a pleasure.
I love it, Jim.
Talk to you soon. 297-5633. We're slated to hear from Paul Feinbaum after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and we're joined at this time by the noted SEC analyst and author, talk show host, Paul Feinbaum, who's been around the Southeastern Conference for well over 3 decades, and he'll be in Baton Rouge at 7 o'clock on Saturday night, August 9th, at Books a Million, 2380 Town Center. Paul Feinbaum, good morning to you.
Thank you, Jim, and it's a great pleasure to be on, and there's just something about Saturday night in Baton Rouge. I'm getting pretty fired up about the football season.
You've spent a few Saturday nights here, I'm sure.
Many, many.
Yeah, and, you know, Nick Saban, a guy you know well, we were talking the other day, he's the only man to ever win games in Tiger Stadium with 3 different teams, LSU, Alabama, and the Miami Dolphins.
You know, I forgot about that. I remember they played there a couple, I think it was an exhibition game, but it's so interesting.
No, it was a real game.
Was it a real game? Okay.
It was after Hurricane Katrina.
Right. No, I do remember that now. And, you know, it's hard to, Jim, I think about Saban so much because of what I've done in my career, and I've always wondered, I haven't dare, and I would never dare bring this up to him, But had he stayed in Baton Rouge and been able to resist the temptation of Wayne Huizenga, there is no telling where Tiger football would be right now. It would I think have blown away college football, because I think he loved Baton Rouge. I shouldn't say this too loudly, but I think that was a slightly better fit for him than Tuscaloosa, even though he's done well there. But there was just something about Nick and Terry Saban and LSU football.
Why do you think it was a better fit?
I think it was a time in his life that was important to him. It was you know, he had been in Michigan State, which was fine, but it wasn't, and he had some history there as well. But he related to people down there, and I think Alabama is a little more suffocating because he walked in there in the shadow immediately of Bear Bryant. Everyone has. I mean, there's no escaping that. Although I will say he's managed to not tear that shadow apart, but he is either equal or surpassed it, depending on one's point of view.
Well, he is a great coach. I think you're saying he has no peer as far as contemporary coaches.
He doesn't, and I argued last season if he had been able to complete the three-peat, I would have easily proclaimed him the greatest coach in Alabama history, which also means you're the greatest coach in college football history.
Mm-hmm.
I still think you can make a case for that. I think if Alabama is able to win this year, and they do have to go through Tiger Stadium, as we all know, I think that's fairly easy. I don't want to take anything away from Paul Bryant. I covered him at the very end of his career, at the very beginning of mine, but I think he won it in a time where the coaches weren't quite as intense, the recruiting wasn't as difficult, and you could also, and LSU did this as well. Bryant often signed four or five players at the same position, not because he really wanted the individual, because he was going to keep it from going to Auburn or Mississippi State or Ole Miss or someone else.
Well, Paul Bryant won his last national championship, 79, beat LSU at Tiger Stadium 3-0. In the rain, and he died a few years later, as we know, in January of 1983. And Nick Saban, when he came to LSU, Paul, he was a 48-year-old journeyman. He was 32-24 at Michigan State. He'd spent most of his career as an assistant coach. LSU paid him a lot of money to get him to come from East Lansing to Baton Rouge, and the rest, they say, is history. Why was he a late bloomer?
I think part of it was that it took him a while to get over himself. I mean, Nick Saban was a difficult personality when he arrived in Baton Rouge. He was a difficult person to deal with even when he arrived in Tuscaloosa. And he was so driven, and he still is, but I think he's learned, and we all go through this, at a certain age, you don't take the foot off the accelerator, but you're able to make better decisions because you're not such a hothead, you're not so possessed, and you're not running over and trampling your assistant coaches and people around you. And he did that. I don't think he would deny it, and I think it made it a little more difficult for him at times. He also walked into, I think, a great situation in Baton Rouge. That program has always been ripe for greatness. You and your audience knows that, but for whatever reason, and I covered LSU at the beginning of my career, the very end of Charlie Mack, LSU sometimes has gotten in its own way. The fans, I love the fans of Baton Rouge and the LSU Nation, but I think they're also the toughest fans I've ever seen. They will eat you and spit you out so quickly, and I think it's the culture of the people there. But Saban embraced that, though, and I think he fed off of it. And the players that he recruited, I did a show yesterday with Tim Tebow and Marcus Spears, who played, of course, at LSU, and just listening to Spears talk about Saban and so many others, I don't know what it was. I know I'm giving you a very long answer, but he walked in there, he understood that this could be magical, he made it magical, and he learned from his mistakes, and he also had a lot of help. The facility upgrade down there, Mark Emmert, gave him what he wanted. The academic center, I think, was revolutionary, and LSU really didn't have any competition in the state, which was also quite important.
297-5633 for Paul Feinbaum, the SEC authority, who will be in Baton Rouge, 7 o'clock Saturday night at Books A Million and Town Center. And he has written a book about the Southeastern Conference. Certainly a terrain that you know quite well.
Yeah, it is. And it's interesting. When this was not a project that I looked for, and I know that sounds a little bit unusual for an author of a book, one in particular who covered the league and who has covered the league as long as I have. But there was an article about me in the New Yorker magazine. They profiled our show, and after that, some literary agent called me and said, this could be a good book. And I said, really? And next thing you know, we had a deal. And so it was interesting to kind of reflect on my career. I did some of that in the book, but you've interviewed many, many authors, and at some point, unless they're president of the United States or maybe governor of Louisiana, their careers aren't that colorful. So I decided to make it three or four books in one, and the narrative of the book is really last season, a 57-year-old rookie on College Game Day, the iconic show of the sport, and I took people through that, what it's like to walk out on a stage in front of 35,000 people and 2 million at home, and it was quite scary, to say the least.
The book is My Conference Can Beat Your Conference, Why the SEC Still Rules College Football, from Paul Feinbaum. Why is the SEC so dominant today?
I think it's partly because of the geography. There aren't a lot of other distractions. Certainly in Baton Rouge, the Saints are important. I mean, the Saints are the state's team. But in most places, there really isn't anything else. In Birmingham, there are no professional teams. In Mississippi, so fans live and die this because, and it's also been successful. It's historical. If you go to a game at Ole Miss, you'll hear about Eli Manning, but you'll also hear about Archie Manning. And you walk down the streets of Manhattan, and if you have an LSU shirt on, an Alabama or an Auburn or a South Carolina fan or even a Michigan fan will walk up to you and start talking because we identify by it. And I think there's also a cultural aspect of it. And I've been asked many, many times, I'm not saying this because of where we are right now.
Yes.
But I've been asked, where, if you had to go, if you had one night to live, where would you go for your final college football game? And I've always said it would be Alabama versus LSU in Tiger Stadium. There's nothing quite like it.
No, but people may not know it, but Paul Feinbaum went to the University of Tennessee. That's a pretty good place. That's a pretty good place, too.
Well, it used to be. It hasn't been in a while, but there are these icons. I mean, you can make a case. And I think that's why this book is the right subject. The SEC is the right subject. You could make a case that the Swamp is the best place. You can argue Tiger Stadium. You could say Auburn. You could say Tuscaloosa. So I think that's why it is fun, and your audience knows that. But I'll still vote for Tiger Stadium on a Saturday night. I've never seen anything like it. 2 years ago, I was down there when LSU, it looked like, had won the game against Alabama, and then Alabama marched down the field in the final seconds. It was one of the most shocking things I'd ever seen when A.J. McCarron completed that long pass to T.J. Yeldon. And I walked out of the stadium, and I didn't hear a sound for 15 minutes. And now fans weren't screaming and hollering and kicking tires. They were just in stunned silence. Mm-hmm. Before the game, I'd never seen a crowd as intense or as electric. I'll never forget that scene as long as I live.
Now, Les Miles is 95-24 in 9 years. He's won 80% of his games, and yet he has the unfortunate reality of having succeeded Nick Saban. It's tough; would have been tough for anybody. How do you rate Miles as a coach?
Very good, but perhaps an accident. Someone who's an accidental coach in history that, if it doesn't end well for him, and I don't know whether it will or not, he'll. Saban will probably be given credit for that championship, but I don't think that's fair. I look at what Les Miles did 2 years ago. He did everything he could possibly do. He won what I consider to be the biggest regular season game in my career when LSU went to Tuscaloosa, and he won that 9-6 game in overtime, and then just, I think, had bad luck. I mean, to have to play Alabama again was asking too much, particularly with Jordan Jefferson as your quarterback, and I wonder if he'll ever escape that, because if he had won that game, he would have had three straight wins against Saban, and the next game being in Baton Rouge with a chance to go four up, and I think the Saban myth might perhaps would have been obliterated, and this book would have been about Les Miles instead.
Well, the Miles record against Saban is 3-5, and he has a winning record against just about everybody else. This is a big game for him, November 8th. Obviously, the Alabama game has become almost like Army-Navy, at least for LSU. But this one is going to be really big for Coach Miles.
I think it is, and I really like him. People call him quirky and crazy, but I think there is a genius there. But I think he has to win this game, though, because otherwise, I know the culture down there. I'll never forget... In 2010, I was down there for a game, and Les was a little, I wouldn't say he was on the hot seat, but fans were getting beside themselves. I went down in the elevator at Tiger Stadium, and he called a timeout. It was fourth down, and fans, the people around the elevator were saying, "Got to fire the guy, he's a bum." And as I stuck my head out in the stadium, the fourth down play was converted to a touchdown. Alabama, he beat Alabama, and it changed that quickly. But that's what LSU fans are. They are not going. They're not. Alabama fans will stick with Saban through thick and thin. LSU fans are more like professional fans, and I think Les has to be careful this year because he doesn't really have a quarterback. I think the freshman will play. He's got the best new player in college football in Fournette, but he has one of the most difficult opening games of anyone on the calendar. And if Wisconsin wins and he stumbles around a little bit early, I think he's going to have he may have a difficult time holding this team together. Now, having said that, if he can withstand the heat of September, I think LSU has a chance to be very good by November 8th.
What do you hear about Fournette?
We were talking yesterday with Tebow and Marcus, and they both kind of cringe when the Adrian Peterson comparisons are made. I mean, I haven't seen him play like some in your audience, but I think he has a chance to become the next great running back. I mean, I won't overwhelm you on a show like this with cliches, but I think that is entirely possible. LSU has a wide receiver that everyone is talking about. So I just think the key at LSU is finding the quarterback, and if that can be done, then I think this program has a chance to return to the promised land.
Who's the best player you've seen in your years of covering the Southeastern Conference?
Herschel Walker. He came out onto the scene like none I had ever seen before. After that, I would probably go with Bo Jackson. You could argue all day in a bar. And then it's kind of open season. Is it Peyton Manning? Is it Tim Tebow? I mean, everyone has their individual accolades, but Herschel just had an impact that I've never seen before.
You think the conference will be able to sustain this level of excellence for the foreseeable future, Paul?
I think so. The advantage for the SEC is the 4-team playoff. Without that, it was really Russian roulette. Alabama has been incredibly fortunate. I mean, they've gotten into the championship game, two times now, losing in November. That really is almost unheard of. But if you look back over the last couple of years, had there been a 4-team playoff, you would have seen two. I mean, obviously we had the championship game 2 years ago in New Orleans. Florida would have gotten in the game. Alabama would have gotten in the game once or twice. So I think it's an advantage, and I also think in the semifinals you'll knock the riffraff out. In other words, the Big Ten.
Well, the Southeastern Conference last year didn't quite make it, although Auburn had a Cinderella season. What about Gus Malzahn? How good of a coach is he?
I think he's very good, but he reminds me, if you go back 10 or 12 years ago, of one of these internet bubble stocks that opens at 25 and the next thing it goes to 2,000 and people just get carried away. I mean, he is innovative, but I've watched the league for almost 35 years, and defenses usually catch up. They couldn't stop him last year. I think this year will be a little different story. By the way, Johnny Manziel is the most exciting player I've ever seen in the league. He was like Elvis with shoulder pads. But John Chavis at LSU shut him down twice. It can be done.
It can be done. And Paul Feinbaum will be in Baton Rouge Saturday night at Books a Million. And we look forward to seeing Paul, 7 o'clock, Town Center. The man who has a degree in political science. Are you ever going to run for office, Paul?
I thought about it. I mean, politics has always been my first love, although I know you swim in those waters. It's becoming a little difficult to pay attention to these days.
Well, good luck to you. It's a pleasure, and we'll see you Saturday.
Can't wait to get down there for no other reason than to eat.
Thank you, Paul. Take care.
Thank you. My pleasure, Jim.
And we shall return tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.